Hello, my name is Stanley Bill. You're listening to Notes from Poland. This week, Tom Lehman interviews me on the life and politics of the Kaczyński brothers. We discuss their careers from the very beginning, the tragedy at Smolensk, and the current prospects of their party, Law and Justice. NotesFromPoland.com is the leading English language source of news, insight, and analysis on Poland. In this podcast, I look at the country from all angles: politics, history, culture, and society. You can get more news and the deeper stories about Poland at notesfrompoland.com. Hello, I'm Stanley Bill. This week, in a special episode of the Notes from Poland podcast, the tables are turned as Tom Lehman interviews me on the political career of Lech and Jarosław Kaczyński, the creators of Poland's current ruling party and arguably the dominant duo of post-1989 domestic politics. This conversation was recorded jointly with Tom's podcast, The Hated and the Dead, which features discussions of the most influential contemporary political figures from across the world. Recent episodes cover Angela Merkel, Viktor Orban, Xi Jinping, and Mikhail Gorbachev, among many others. In this episode, we explore the success and significance of the Kaczyńskis and their politics.
Hi, Stan. How are you doing?
Well, thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Stan, we're talking about the Kaczyński brothers today. Lech served as president of Poland from 2005 until 2010, and his twin brother Jarosław was the prime minister in 2006, and he still serves as the chairman of the Law and Justice Party today. They were born in 1949 in Warsaw, and in a sense, they've been in the public eye since their childhood, haven't they?
That's right. Well, they both famously appeared in a film when they were quite small children, and twin brothers, of course, and that was quite a famous film at the time. So in that sense, as you say, being in the public eye is something that they're very accustomed to. Having said that, they weren't exactly in the public eye for several decades, but it's certainly the case that Jarosław Kaczyński in particular is probably the dominant figure in Polish politics in the period after the fall of communism in 1989. He's certainly the most successful politician domestically in Poland in that period, at least if we measure it by the number of years that his party has been in power or that he's had a say in or even control over the appointment of the government. So he's been an extremely successful figure, and he's a figure that we can strongly identify with the overarching shape of the politics of Poland since 1989.
I know twins who get on quite well with one another, who really are two peas in a pod, sort of temperamentally as well as biologically. How did the two of them get on? Do we have much sense of what their relationship was like? It seems like a bit of a risk to assume, just by dint of them being twins, that they were close and that they got on, you know, not politically, but in a personal sense. I want to get to their political relationship a bit later on, but just on a personal basis, do we have much idea of what their relationship was like?
I think we do. I mean, I certainly don't pretend to know anything about the private life of the Kaczyński brothers, and I can only go on what others have written, but what they have also written and what they've said, and simply from what one could see of their behavior publicly. And it seemed that they had a very, very close relationship for all of their lives. According to their own accounts, they were in constant contact all of the time, even when they were not living in the same place. And they were quite different temperamentally, by all reports. A major difference that would emerge in their adulthood is simply the fact that Lech Kaczyński married and had a family, had a daughter, and always had that aspect of his life, whereas Jarosław Kaczyński never did. But that also meant that he was often in the orbit of Lech's family and spent a lot of time with them, as he'd always spent a lot of time with his brother. So they describe their bond as being extremely close, and when they have talked about it, and one can see the effect that the passing of Lech in 2010 had on Jarosław, and the fact that he still to this day is always dressed in black in mourning for the loss of his brother when he appears in public. And when he speaks of that loss, it's clearly something that he has never gotten over. And in many ways, that tragic event did have an effect on Polish politics after 2010. And that's something that we can perhaps talk about later on.
Lech and Jarosław were brought up under communism. And their generation, as I said, they're born in the late 40s. Their generation is significant because it was the generation that brought communism down, in a sense. Poland was a satellite state of the Soviet Union. And the movement everybody remembers as the main agent of the downfall of communism was the trade union that became known as Solidarity. It might be worth pondering on the type of movement that Solidarity was for a second, because given the type of politics that the Kaczynskis have come to represent, it might be worth noting that Solidarity wasn't a trade union in the kind of narrow left-wing terms that we think of trade unions in the UK now. What space did the Kaczynski twins occupy in Solidarity?
That's absolutely right. It was a very diverse movement. And as you say, it was not just a trade union, but became a kind of national liberation movement of a certain kind. That was a very broad-based movement. The Solidarity had up to 10 million members at the height of its success in the early 1980s. But it was internally diverse because it was a kind of alliance of different groups that wanted to, at least in some cases, reform or change the government, and increasingly to overthrow it and to establish democracy in Poland, although that was a process of evolution and wasn't necessarily a view that all shared at all times, and it wasn't necessarily the intent of the accords that were reached in 1980 either. But it was a movement that very much had left and right wings. So in very broad terms, you can talk about a left wing, many of which had come out of revisionist circles in the 1960s, revisionist circles of young people, many of them the children of Communist Party functionaries. So people like Adam Michnik, for example, an enemy of Jarosław Kaczyński in later years and the editor-in-chief of the well-known Gazeta Wyborcza newspaper. But his kind of group, which started out as a sort of movement to change the face of the regime, and in some sense, for it to realize what its ideological claims about itself were. But then there was a right wing, and of course, I'm speaking in very broad terms, there were lots of sort of splinters within those broad wings, but a right wing that was more conservative and nationalist, even in some cases, in its views. We should also remember that there was a nationalist dimension to communism itself. Certain moments and certain wings of the Communist Party were nationalist in their ideology. That's what they presented. But certainly, this is a different kind of national idea that the right wing members of Solidarity espoused, one that is tied to a traditional identity that's connected with the Catholic Church. And there's an extent to which, at a point in time, Lech Wałęsa, at least in part, represents that. And of course, famously, when he signed the Solidarity Accords and he had this big pen with the religious imagery on it. And so that meant that it was a movement that was always internally divided, and there was always an understanding of that, and there were always disagreements and rivalries within Solidarity. But as long as the main enemy was the party, this authoritarian single-party system, then they were able to all work together in different ways towards the goal of confronting that system. But once that system was overthrown, inevitably, and in a way that I'm sure all of them on some level understood as soon as that became a reality, naturally, they divided into different factions in a way that one would expect in a contested democracy where there is a marketplace of ideas and different political movements. So Solidarity was never homogeneous, and the Kaczynski brothers belonged to the more conservative wing.
You mentioned the Catholic Church a second ago. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this is an immensely important institution in Poland. It has been for a very long time, but I think it's fair to say it probably took on an extra importance after the fall of communism, because it was a sort of constant amid all this socioeconomic and political change. How religious were the brothers?
Again, that's a question that sort of enters into the personal, that I couldn't tell you what Jarosław Kaczynski's sort of underlying convictions are. He certainly says that he's a Roman Catholic. He's repeatedly said in recent years that not only is Catholicism important to Poland and crucial to Polish identity, but there is no other viable value system for the nation, as he understands it. This is the value system that exists in Poland, and that anybody that rejects that particular value system is essentially rejecting values altogether. That's what he has said on a number of occasions. But what his underlying faith is, I don't know. But what I can say is that the importance of religion and the importance of the church and the Catholic aspect of national identity and the connection between religion and politics has certainly changed over his time in politics. So it was not particularly prevalent as a part of his political platform in the period of his first party, which is called the Center Agreement, Porozumienie Centrum, in the early 1990s. And certainly on the question of values, they did have conservative views, and they would have associated themselves with Catholicism in broad terms, as a lot of political circles did in Poland. As you say, that was a moment of triumph for the church, really, and of the church's of great influence for the Catholic Church in the early 1990s. But it wasn't an important part of their platform necessarily. And even in the early 2000s, at the very beginning of peace, it was not as central as it is now. So the key period really for this change is the period of 2005 to 2007, where peace enters into a coalition that includes a small party called the League of Polish Families that's ultra-Catholic in its ideology. And that's when Kaczynski starts to see the importance of this ideology, as they eventually take over the electorate essentially of that party and take over their alliances with very conservative Catholic circles and media circles. But that's something that happens, you know, somewhat later in Kaczynski's political career. So there is an evolution there. It's not a complete change. As I said, in broad terms, his political views, you know, would have always given some place to Catholic social doctrine and values, and was certainly socially conservative, but not so important necessarily.
You mentioned peace there, in its English translation, Law and Justice. This is the party that the brothers set up in 2001.
Yes.
If you think about the 1990s in Poland, which was the first decade of transition away from communism and away from dictatorship and broadly towards a sort of Western style of democratic capitalism, that was the intention. If you think about that decade, what issues were the brothers seeking to reflect in this new political party at the start of the 21st century?
Well, through part of the 90s, they were in the wilderness, really. Because they had influence in the early 1990s, Jarosław Kaczynski in particular, and we probably want to go back and talk a little bit more about Solidarity and the transition. But if we're on the 1990s, then at the beginning of the 90s, Kaczynski was involved in the formation of a short-lived government. And this is a moment that he and his political circles would look back to as a crucial moment. A right-wing government that was in 1991, that was overthrown in 1992, overthrown according to process in the parliament, because they never had a majority and there was a realignment. But it's something that there's controversy around that, because in the background, there are these files on politicians that were found that supposedly showed that some of them were former communist agents. And the theory of the right wing is that this was behind the overthrow of the government. People didn't want this to come out, including Lech Wałęsa, who was then the president. But in any case, that was a government that fell. And then in 1993, the post-communist party got into power. And so the former members of the communist party who had reinvented themselves as democratic politicians were legitimately elected by the people of Poland. And it was seen as a dramatic failure for the right. It was seen as a dramatic failure for the post-Solidarity camp in general. And Lech and Jarosław spent periods not even having a seat in the parliament. It was a very, very difficult period. It was a difficult period politically. It was a difficult period financially for them and their political circles. They struggled to get by even for large periods. And then they began to reinvent themselves towards the end of the 1990s. But to answer your question about what their priorities were, the priorities were in the stakes as they saw it at the beginning of the 90s in that short-lived government that I was talking about and its overthrow, as they saw it, was the need to accelerate and radicalize reform. So they said very, very clearly that the reform process was happening too slowly and that it had been too easy for former members of the party or people in positions of influence under the old communist regime to take power in different forms in the new democratic state, be it political positions or taking over interests in new companies that had been formed on the basis of the old state-run companies, and that therefore the people who, as justice should have dictated in their view, who should have been punished, were instead thriving under the new system, while those who had suffered and gone through, you know, many struggles to produce the change in solidarity, many of them were not benefiting from the transition at all. So a sense that the transition was fundamentally unjust, and therefore the track of that transition needed to be accelerated, as that was the term that they tended to use at the beginning of the 1990s, and then later on completely revised and changed to undo in a way what had happened before. And that sense of undoing the injustice of the transition would remain very important in the platform of the current party, or the ruling party in Poland, Law and Justice, PiS. And it's still something that PiS talks about, for instance, when it defends its reforms of the judiciary and various other measures that they've taken. So that's, I'd say, at the heart of their political program in the 1990s.
Siblings in politics are not that uncommon. Twins in politics are obviously rarer. I don't think we've ever had a prominent set of twins in British politics. Somebody will probably correct me. But was being identical twins an advantage for them in the 2000s as they began to rise through politics, the 90s and 2000s? I imagine it might provide a certain sense of omnipotence to your image, but it could also mean that people get really sick of you.
It's an interesting question. I don't know whether it really helped. I mean, it helped them or not. There was certainly a lot of satire of their sameness, of course, and they were often mocked. There was a period where there was a Kaczynski who was both prime minister and president, of course, in 2006. So it often seemed to be a burden, if anything, but they did work very well as a tandem. And this comes back to your earlier question about what their relationship was. The understanding that tends to be related about how they operated is that Kaczynski was the dominant strategist, and that he tended to dictate the terms
of... Which
Kaczynski? Sorry, I didn't say the name. Jarosław Kaczynski.
Right.
Jarosław Kaczynski was supposedly the dominant twin, so to speak. Again, I don't want to sort of make assertions about things connected with personalities that are hard to judge from the outside, but there are a lot of... There's some evidence to suggest that. So he would be making plans behind the scenes, whereas Lech was more likely to take the important positions. And there were certain times where he was, in a sense, the front man. Now, it's not that Jarosław Kaczynski was never in that role. He certainly was at different points in time. But as we know, he's often preferred to be in the back seat, controlling things from behind. Whereas Lech Kaczynski, he filled a whole range of different important offices. So in the president's office under Lech Wałęsa, Kaczynski also had a role there. But also, he's been a member of parliament. He's been a senator. He's been the state auditor. He's been the mayor of Warsaw and the president of Poland. And importantly, at the end of the 1990s, and this was a role that helped the Kaczynskis to get their political career back on the rails and to get out of the wilderness that I was talking about before, is that he became the justice minister at the very end of the 1990s, or it may have been 2000, in another one of these coalition post-solidarity governments. It was not a Kaczynski-controlled government. He was somewhat unexpectedly given this position. And he managed to gather quite a lot of political capital as a sort of fire and brimstone justice minister who was going to pursue criminals and who was going to give the public a sense that something was being done about injustices that they saw in the criminal justice system, for example. And that's why, of course, the party is called Law and Justice, because they sort of began on that platform. But that was on the back of Lech, who at that moment was a more recognizable figure and a more important figure and became the head of the party at the beginning of its existence. So they were a very good tandem. So if you mean that, that was an advantage perhaps as twins, that they had this extremely close relationship. They understood each other very well, very intuitively. They had absolute trust in each other and they were able to operate very effectively.
I think what you've just described sets up quite well the fact that in autumn 2005, there was a presidential election and a parliamentary election. And it was Lech that won the presidential election and went to the president's palace. And it was Jarosław that went to the parliament. I think that you've kind of set
That's right, but not as prime minister, of course, initially.
Oh, yes.
So he had one of many prime ministers that he's chosen, and he's sort of really controlling things from the back seat.
I did a podcast on Viktor Orban a few weeks ago, and it transpired that quite a lot of the sort of right-wing populism that Orban now espouses wasn't really on show in the 2000s, early 2000s, when he was prime minister first time. Law and justice are frequently referred to as right-wing populists now, but is that observation about Orban true about them too? Have they sort of changed over time? I mean, you mentioned where a lot of the kind of hardline law and order stuff, the law part of their name comes from. But what does, if you look at that first government and the first period of power after 2005, what was the ideology? I mean, what's the justice side of the name?
Well, the justice is certainly partly that transitional justice that I was talking about before. And that was definitely part of the program in 2005. Again, that sense that the transition from communism to free market democracy had not been just that those who had been part of the regime had benefited and others, particularly in regional areas, had suffered economically, as well as in the sense of their cultural values having been denigrated and not having a political say. So that's part of it. But yeah, I think in broad terms, you're right that if we look back to 2005, one might not be so inclined to describe Law and Justice as a populist party. There's certainly continuity in many of their ideas and policies, but much of it is not quite as radical as it became. And part of that change is what I was referring to before, which is this period of quite chaotic coalition government that they had in 2005 to 2007, where they were in coalition with these two smaller parties, both of whom, in different ways, certainly had populist agendas. So this is Sama Obrona, which came out of this kind of rural farmers' protest movement, and then the League of Polish Families, which was ultra-Catholic, anti-EU accession. And that coalition really didn't work, and there were earlier elections in 2007 and PiS lost power. But what people who are experts in the history of Polish politics often talk about that essentially happened is that PiS swallowed up these two parties and their electorates. Those two parties more or less disappeared, and PiS took part of their policy platforms and part of their electorates. And that inevitably drove them in an increasingly populist direction and further to the right on some of the cultural issues that we were talking about before, the religious issues. And so there's this closer connection from that point in time with, for example, the conservative Catholic media networks of a well-known priest called Tadeusz Rydzyk. It's a very well-known character in Poland. He started this network called Radio Maria, which is a Catholic radio station, and then there are television stations and other media around that. And Rydzyk had been aligned essentially with the League of Polish Families earlier, and relations between him and the Kaczyńskis were a little bit mixed. In fact, there was a famous moment of controversy when Maria Kaczyńska, the wife of Lech Kaczyński, had seemed to be in favor of, if not removing, at least making the abortion restrictions on abortion in Poland less radical than they had become, and was privately, in very rude terms, attacked by Father Rydzyk, this very influential priest, for that reason. So the relations were not always very close, but then they became close, and then they became allies. And in a way, Law and Justice took over from the League of Polish Families as the patrons and the political sponsors of that religious grouping, and are to this day. And Rydzyk is a very important political ally of Kaczyński, who has been very reliable. And Kaczyński has been on the record saying of the elections in 2015 that it would have been much harder to win them without the support of Rydzyk. And Rydzyk has been in turn rewarded by very, very large grants of state money to his various foundations and other organizations.
I want to turn to the events of 2010. Lech Kaczyński had been president of Poland for 5 years when he was killed in a plane crash over Smolensk in Russia. I don't think there's any kind of close Western European equivalent to this event politically anyway. The closest thing I can think of is the plane crash that killed most of the Manchester United squad in 1958. What effect did this have on Polish society? I mean, it's worth mentioning first, if you don't mind, that obviously Lech Kaczyński wasn't the only person that was killed in that plane crash.
It was around 100 people that were killed in that plane crash from different political circles and different groups in society, many of them representatives of elites. it had a devastating effect, I think, on Polish society and politics, because it radicalized divisions that were certainly already there, but it opened them up and turned them into gaping wounds that really could not be healed. And it turned political rivalries, for instance, between Donald Tusk and Jarosław Kaczyński, that had already been very, very fierce rivalries, and there was no love lost between those two already. But it turned those rivalries into great enmities and into relationships that could never function in the way that in some democracies it's possible to have fierce political rivalries and yet there to be certain kinds of agreement over key issues and for personal relations to be okay between different groups. Kaczyński certainly seems to blame members of Donald Tusk's political circles and Donald Tusk himself. On some level, at least, he's quite cryptic about exactly what kind of blame he is assigning. And of course, there are all kinds of theories that have come around the crash. None of them are convincing with respect to a conspiracy. It does seem to be an accident with a significant amount of fault on the Russian side, but also some fault on the Polish side with respect to organization and the choices that the pilots made. Of course, I'm not an aviation expert, but that would seem to be the consensus opinion outside of peace's political circles. But clearly, there were a range of theories, certainly blaming Russia. And of course, those theories feel more credible today than they might have before. But nevertheless, those theories often suggested that the Polish government of the time, which is Donald Tusk's party, the Civic Platform, Platforma Obywatelska, PO, were at least morally responsible, as Kaczyński's often put it, by organizing the visit to Katyn, which was going to be this memorial for Polish officers that had been murdered by the Soviet NKVD at the beginning of the 1940s, that the trip was organized in such a way that was based on political ill will and that created the chain of events that led to the possibility of what Russia may have done, according to the narrative that Kaczyński's investigative committees seem to be presenting now. In some circles, those theories are more radical to suggest that there was some kind of conspiracy between the Russians and Tusk and his party. That kind of polarization may have been happening anyway and may have continued to radicalize even without the Smolensk accident, but it certainly created extraordinary political tensions. But then those tensions were visible in the society as well. So there was some symbolic clashes that happened in the public space in Warsaw between those who were closely tied to Kaczyński's camp and who were mourning the president and wanted a cross to stand in the public space in front of the presidential palace for a long time, and then others who wanted the cross to be taken down. And there were quite unpleasant public clashes, not necessarily violent in most cases, but it was clear that this was a society that was deeply divided, and this event exacerbated that.
I think it's been mostly in the sort of last decade that law and justice, peace have become more contentious both inside Poland and outside. And I want to try and explore the reasons for that a bit. One of the fascinating things about Poland's post-89 history is that its economy has grown fantastically well. I don't think it even suffered a downturn in 2008, when the rest of Europe was obviously reeling from the financial crisis. Mm-hmm. To lots of commentators in the 90s, economic growth was thought to kind of lead to convergence on Western liberalism and democracy. This was kind of the recipe. The Polish situation would suggest, firstly, that that's not exactly true, but also that Poland's or Polish people's dissatisfaction isn't economic, really. You know, you don't usually go towards populist nationalist conservatism without some sort of widespread dissatisfaction. What grievances are the people who support law and justice harboring? I mean, you mentioned abortion a second ago, and obviously you mentioned the kind of long-held beliefs about what happened after 1989 and in the transition. What else would you add to that list?
I think you've framed the question very intelligently, actually, and it's a very interesting and important question in terms of that mainstream narrative of what's supposed to happen in a transition like this one and the way in which Poland from the middle of the 2010s at least seems to go against that assumption. There are a few things here, and I think one thing that you suggest is important, which is it's not just the economy, stupid, to misquote Bill Clinton. cultural issues are important to people and have an autonomous political meaning, irrespective of the economic underpinnings. This is what some political scientists would focus on today. And in fact, there is a bit of a debate about which is more important, the political aspects or the cultural aspects or the economic aspects of populist success. And I think it's certainly the case that there has been anxiety in parts of Polish society about the speed of certain kinds of cultural changes and a sense of being left behind, a sense that the values of the country are changing in a way that makes it unrecognizable. And here we also need to think about regional differences, which are very, very important. And in very simplifying terms, you can talk about an urban-rural divide in Poland, which you can map onto, grossly simplifying, but in a way that has some explanatory value, mapping onto the party division. So PiS is the party of the village and the small towns, where most Polish people live. The majority of the Polish population lives in villages and small towns. We're talking about towns of 20,000 people and less. Whereas Civic Platform has much better support, greater support in larger cities, where a minority of the Polish population, as it happens, lives. And I think the transition was experienced very differently by people living in villages and small towns. And in my experience in Poland, I happen to know the countryside very well, and the PiS heartland is a part of the country that's very close to me. I like this part of the, I'm talking about the southeast in particular, the Subcarpathian region. And I have connections to that region, and I spend a lot of time there. And it is very different from Warsaw, or from Wrocław, or from Gdańsk. There is a much higher sense of connection with Catholic values, for instance. There are higher levels of religious practice, although they're falling in those villages as well. And there is a sense that their life is different from the lives of people that are in Warsaw. And that's where we're not just talking about the cultural values. So this would be anxieties about the kinds of hot button issues that we're familiar with, like LGBT plus rights, immigration, those kinds of changes that can make people anxious in some parts of the country and are easy to harness politically. But those parts of the country also experienced the economic transition very differently. And so that's the second part of the point I want to make, is it's not just the economy, but the economic issues are also important. And this is where, yes, as you said, Poland's economic growth is extremely impressive, and it continues across the period of the post-1989 period after the initial dip in the early 1990s. And then once Poland joins the European Union in 2004, it really takes off and has kept going since then. And as you said, wasn't even halted by the financial crisis of 2008. And that growth did reach all parts of the country one way or another. If you look at any measure of median wages, of minimum wages, they've all grown. But it is the case that those in the larger cities benefited much, much more. And there is evidence of a certain growth in inequality. Now, everybody's conditions have improved, but subjectively, these are the kinds of questions that are interesting to ask and that political scientists and other scholars are asking, is the extent to which the feeling of a distinction between you and others and a growth of the distinction between you and others, even if you yourself are doing better, in some ways increases a sense of resentment in some parts of the country. And there's no question that there are differences. And it's a significant part of PiS's success, is that PiS rhetorically and then delivering on rhetoric, at least to some extent in policy, did give people in those neglected regions of the country, relatively neglected regions of the country, a sense that there was going to be attention on them now, and that there was going to be money coming their way, but not just money, but a sense that they were being listened to. It's very interesting, for instance, that after PiS came to power in 2015, sociological surveys that asked people the question, do people like you have a say in the affairs of the country? The number of people that said yes increased after PiS came to power. So there's something of a sense of enfranchisement as against an earlier feeling of neglect.
Yeah, the perception of inequality is in a way more important than the
exactly.
Well, that
exactly.
was something about the Gini coefficient, and
exactly
I think,
right.
I mean, I think what you're kind of describing is a sort of catharsis on the point of the people that live in the southeast of the country, particularly. But if we look at some of the effects and what the peace government since 2015 have done in terms of attempts to play to people that feel that way. It's not just sort of kind of big, larger tax transfers to small towns and villages for Poles. I've read Western media reports about what have been described in sort of inverted commas as LGBT-free zones. Is this a kind of embellished news story, or is this an attitude about gay people that's actually quite pervasive within Polish society?
To some extent, it's an exaggerated account because there were not any zones of any legal standing that were established anywhere. There were certain regional authorities that passed declarations, essentially, that didn't actually have any specific legal consequences, that said that they were in principle against what they call LGBT ideology. Now, as critics of those local authorities would point out, it did seem to be code for we're against LGBT people. And obviously, any individual who would identify in that way living in one of those regions would clearly feel that that is not a welcoming region to them. So that in itself was bad enough, in my opinion. But it's not an LGBT-free zone in any legal or concrete sense. So that term came in particularly when there were some activists who were going around putting those signs up in localities that had issued those declarations as a protest against them. But nevertheless, the rhetoric was very real. And the rhetoric was not just from local authorities, but it was used in two elections, in the 2019 parliamentary election and in the 2020 presidential election, to whip up fear in order to motivate members of PiS's most conservative base. Because, of course, turnout in elections is crucially important. And if you can get out your hardcore supporters and make sure they are in the booth on election day, then you're winning half the battle. And that was the intent of that. And it was a vicious campaign, rhetorically, to the extent that on the eve of the 2019 parliamentary elections, public television, which, as you probably know, has been entirely co-opted as a tool of Law and Justice's propaganda, screened a documentary film called Invasion, entitled Invasion, about this LGBT ideology that had invaded the country, supposedly, on the backs of foreign operatives, indeed. So it was German LGBT activists who were coming in and whipping up local Polish LGBT activists in a way that was not consonant with the culture of our country as this was being presented. So it was a vicious campaign and a campaign that deserves condemnation of the strongest kind, but it's not quite the same as what it sometimes appeared to be in some of the Western media. There really weren't any specific legal measures that were introduced. So important to make that distinction while still condemning the rhetoric as bad enough in itself.
Yeah. I just want to get back to this idea of perception, because it's quite interesting on the social side of things as well as the economic. Presumably, quite a lot of the anti-LGBT, anti-abortion sentiment and rhetoric comes from the Catholic Church. You mentioned Rydzek earlier. Do you think that the Catholic conservative people in Poland have become more religiously fanatical over the last 30 years? Or do you think that sort of urban liberals have simply moved away from them more and the Catholics have remained as religious as they ever were? This is often quite an interesting thing that I think about Islam as well. It's often said that Islam has become more fanatical over the last 50 years, but of course that's happened at the same time as Western society has become more liberal and more secular. So perhaps from that vantage point, yes, Islam looks more fanatical, but actually it hasn't moved. It's just Western liberalism has sort of moved in the opposite direction. That was quite a long-winded question, but I see
the point you're making, but with respect to radicalization of Catholicism in Poland, in fact, the opposite is true. So the survey evidence over a couple of decades now shows very clearly that Poles are becoming less religious, And interestingly, that process is accelerated, if anything, since peace came into government in 2015. They have become more open to less restrictive abortion regulations, and they have become more open to LGBT plus people, but also to the idea of civil partnerships and even to gay marriage. So, in fact, there is plenty of evidence to suggest that Polish society is moving in the opposite direction. Now, it's moving slowly but surely over that period. And secondly, what that perhaps suggests, if we want to come to what you were talking about before, so what do we make of Rydzyk, or why, therefore, are there these seemingly fanatical, as you described them, sort of religious policies and rhetoric? In part, I think those who do hold very conservative views feel a kind of siege mentality, which might be inclined to radicalize some of the expressions of their ideas. But secondly, I think it makes them more intent to use the political circumstances that they have to get things through that they want, with the sense that Polish society is changing under them. So the abortion law, and we really need to differentiate the LGBT plus issue from the abortion issue, because with respect to gay marriage, for instance, it's still a minority of Poles that support gay marriage, but it's increased significantly. And some surveys suggest more than 50% would be in favor of civil partnerships now. So it's really changed, and it will probably continue to change as the years go by. And there's certainly less hostility towards LGBT plus people, for example, than there may once have been. On abortion, for instance, it is a very interesting issue. It's obviously an issue of great significance, and it directly hits women and their rights and their bodies in Poland. And so it's very important. But it's an interesting issue politically, because it's one of not many questions where peace has acted against the general view of Poles in policy. Now, it did it not by passing a law, and that was precisely because they knew that there was not majority support for a radicalization of the abortion restrictions, which is, of course, what happened in 2020. The majority is in favor either of keeping the original compromise, which was already very restrictive, called a compromise because the church in the 1990s wanted a complete ban, and the compromise was to have a very restrictive law, or to liberalize the law. And peace, partly under the pressure of the Catholic allies that we've been talking about before, and part of its base, some of its members of parliament as well, because they hold those views, couldn't get it through the parliament, but they used the path of their captured constitutional court that declared the law was unconstitutional, and that therefore the clauses of the abortion law that made it possible to have an abortion when there was irreparable damage to the fetus must be struck out. And that is not a popular move in Poland, and it remains unpopular. And there certainly does seem to be something of the pendulum effect that support for liberalization, not just a return to the former compromise in inverted commas, but support for liberalization is growing. And that is reflected by the fact that for the first time, Donald Tusk's party, the Civic Platform, has come out that it wants to put the liberalization of the abortion law in its political program, which it's never had the boldness to do before, because it's also ultimately a center-right Christian democracy type party. So that would answer your question, I think, pretty clearly, that we're not seeing a radicalization or a sort of fanatical religion in Poland on the whole.
If you go by election results alone, Law and Justice don't seem to have quite the same grip on power as Viktor Orban's party do in Hungary, Fidesz. And obviously, it's, you know, different political systems, different countries. But Law and Justice tend to win presidential elections quite narrowly. Their majorities in parliament have been a lot smaller. They've actually lost elections since 2005, obviously. Orban, by contrast, took back power in 2010, and he's never left. And yet, the Kaczynskis and Orban are often lumped in together as these kind of illiberal democrats. That's what they're often referred to. Do Law and Justice respect democracy more than Orban, do you think? Or are they just not as effective in limiting democracy as he is?
I would say the latter. They have followed Orban and the success of his party and his policies on many, many points. They have essentially imitated those, and they've been very specific about doing so. So Jarosław Kaczyński famously said on election night in 2011, when he lost the second election in a row, that there would be Budapest on the Vistula. In other words, that they would bring the Hungarian success of Orbán to Poland eventually, which they did. But they never won the supermajorities that Orbán won, which allowed Orbán to change the constitution and to have a completely different level of political domination than what peace has been able to achieve. There also seems to have been, and I'm not an expert on Hungary, so I wouldn't want to make a comparison that's too detailed, but it seems at least that Polish civil society that has been more robust in its resistance to what peace has tried to do. There are also, because they haven't won the super majorities that Orbán has won, it means that the political opposition, although it's been disorganized and in the wilderness, as Kaczyński once was, has never been completely smashed. So there have been still significant opposition parties that have maintained continuity and have powerful organizational bases and can rebuild, as they are doing now. And in fact, to the extent that they are a very realistic chance of winning as a coalition of opposition parties in 2023. And so all of those are fundamental differences. One thing, though, that I would say is something of a difference between Orbán and Kaczyński is that Orbán has obviously set up this sort of oligarchic network of politically subservient allies that have taken over different businesses and that feed off the state. And there is a sense of political corruption, quite simply, in Hungary. Now, that has not been absent in Poland, and there are more and more cases of it. Obviously, as the longer peace is in power, the more and more of these things come out, as the same thing happened to the Civic Platform Party before. But it's not on the same level as what's happened in Hungary. And Kaczyński himself seems to be a person who is not motivated by money or material goods. And he's always been very, very wary of the image of that kind of enrichment happening among members of his party. Now, it is happening, and it's always been the case in Polish politics that one thing you do to your supporters is give them plump positions in state-owned companies where they sit on the boards, don't do much, and get big salaries. And there are all kinds of state positions that supporters can be put into. That's been happening under peace, but it's happened under others as well. But particularly egregious cases of abuse, Kaczynski's always been very careful to crack down on that, and indeed even to kick people out of the party. And part of that almost seems to be a personal difference between Orbán and Kaczynski, that Kaczynski's just not motivated by that and sees it as an evil that he must, to some degree, quash in his party, even as he understands the reality that you have to be able to reward your loyal supporters.
I want to touch very briefly on Poland and the European Union. One of the reasons that I've sort of thrown a couple of comparisons at you between the Kaczynskis and Orbán is that Poland and Hungary are seen as the kind of two enemies within, by many people, the two enemies within the European Union, these two kind of awkward so-and-sos. I was interviewing a journalist called Victoria Serdult about Orbán. And she said that because Hungary is a fairly small country and because it doesn't have a sort of large kind of military, although Orbán and Hungary is quite annoying for the European Union, they don't have very much leverage. Poland, by contrast, obviously is a much larger economy. It sends much more of its labor abroad to other European countries, and it's vehemently anti-Russian, which Hungary is not. Her take on this was that gives Poland much more leverage in the EU and thereby, in some ways, makes Poland much more dangerous to the European Union than Hungary. Do you agree?
Possibly. I think Poland is more important, certainly, than Hungary and the European Union. And that is possibly a factor in the slightly different ways in which the European institutions have responded to Poland than to Hungary, for example. But I also think that part of the issue here for Poland is that Hungary came first, and Hungary did all kinds, that Orbán's party introduced all kinds of measures that were not viewed favorably in Brussels or in other European capitals, but not much was done about it. And in a sense, in hindsight, I think many saw that as a mistake. And so when Poland was then following, doing many of the same things, and without the constitutional supermajority that gave Orban something of a pretext, at least. There was a sense of having learned from mistakes, and therefore I think there was more willingness to act. And therefore the conflict has been more overt and has had clearer specific consequences, probably, for Poland than for Hungary. I think the other aspect is that Orban is a much smoother political operator in Brussels than any of PiS's functionaries have been. And of course, Kaczynski doesn't operate in Brussels. He sends other people to do it on his behalf. But Orban has been very successful at pontificating about things in his own country and then going to Brussels and finding a way to work something out, possibly even making small concessions on certain things, and certainly willing to throw his allies in PiS under the bus if need be, as he did in the famous vote to give Donald Tusk a second term in his position as president of the European Council. So I think those factors are at play. As for the threat to the European Union, again, it's not my area of particular expertise, and to some extent that's a political question of what a threat to the European Union looks like. It depends what your vision of the European Union is, I suppose. But it clearly appears to many in Brussels that Poland is a threat to European unity, is a threat to fundamental European principles, and therefore there has been a much higher level of willingness to do something about that in the last year or so. And so we see, of course, Poland's European recovery funds being blocked and then other European funds also being blocked at the moment. So there is action happening now that simply didn't happen several years ago. So the perception of that threat must be there on some level in Brussels.
But because of the benefits that Poland accrues from EU membership and the size and importance of Poland to the EU, it's very unlikely that Poland leaves the EU anytime soon, isn't it?
Yes, it's very, very unlikely. So the support for membership of the European Union is extremely high in Poland. It's among the highest, in some polls, the highest across the Union, which means that for a party in Poland to put leaving the European Union on its ticket would be suicide today. And there is no way for Poland to be kicked out of the European Union, as you know. There is no procedure or mechanism for that to happen. And the only thing I would say is that I think as the balance of payments changes, so as Poland shifts in time, and this may happen relatively soon in the medium term, from being a very large net beneficiary of the European budget to being somewhat neutral or maybe even at some point a net contributor to the European budget, then I think the picture will change a bit. And I certainly wouldn't rule out the possibility that in the medium term, it becomes viable for a political party to put leaving the European Union, or at least fundamentally changing the relationship with the European Union, on their electoral ticket. And there are some forces within Kaczynski's broader coalition who would be obvious candidates for doing that and are already extremely fierce in their criticism of the EU. And they certainly posture about Poland leaving the European Union. And the occasional politician might say something that suggests he thinks they should leave. Now, they don't actually put it on their policy program as such, and it's not the position of Kaczynski's coalition, but they're already saying those things. And I think it could become policy of some party, you know, within the next 5 years or so even. But it will not be a party that will win majority support in Poland, in my opinion.
To bring this back to Jarosław, the surviving Kaczynski brother, him and his kind of main opponent, Donald Tusk, you've mentioned him a couple of times, are both pretty unpopular today. 30 years on from the democratic transition, I think Polish democracy seems perhaps quite weary, I think. I'm not sure whether you'd accept that description. But both of those politicians have been around for quite a long time. There's certainly a weariness with them. Whether there is with democracy is an interesting question. But is there any politician or party that seems to be rejuvenating things a bit in Poland? What does this next sort of couple of years look like, do you think?
It's a really interesting question. And I also sometimes reflect on that, the fact that you have these names that were in there in the political controversy in 1991 that I talked about, this overthrow of a right-wing government that Kaczynski was involved in, that sort of they treat as a foundational moment for the establishment of the system that they now want to overthrow. Tusk and Kaczynski were key figures in that moment. And here we are over 30 years later, and they're still key figures at the center of Polish politics. And it certainly does open the question of where is the new generation? Now, Kaczynski has said that he will step down as the chairman of the Law and Justice Party in 2025. He said it before, and he reiterated this again recently, so that the 2023, as they probably will be, 2023 parliamentary elections would be his last. Now, this is going to open up an almighty battle within PiS and its broader coalition over who is going to take over the leadership of the party and the leadership of the right more generally in Poland. And there are no clear victors that we could point to now that we would anticipate. So there doesn't seem to be anybody who is the obvious candidate to be the representative of that new generation on that side. On the side of Civic Platform, Donald Tusk, there is, of course, Rafał Trzaskowski, the mayor of Warsaw, who came very close to defeating Andrzej Duda in the presidential elections in 2020, but he failed. However, he seemed after that election to try to begin the process of establishing his own independent political force, but he's stepped right back from that now, and he's a somewhat less prominent figure than he was ever since Tusk came back to take over the leadership of the party, which was a role that Trzaskowski may have aspired to take over and may have been in line to take over at a certain point in time. Now, he's also not very young, but he's younger than Tusk, and he's certainly a different generation, and he has less political baggage than Tusk. There's less dislike for him in the electorate than there is for Tusk. So he is perhaps a figure for the future for that side of politics. And then every so often, new voices pop up, but they find it hard to establish themselves. So there was the case of Robert Biedroń, who started out as an LGBT plus rights campaigner and then became an important figure in the left and formed his own party, which had a brief period of polling very well and looking like it could build a new force on the left. But he's really faded into insignificance. And then more recently, you have the centrist Catholic figure who's quite close in a lot of his ideas to Tusk and his party, Szymon Hołownia, the former TV presenter. And he seemed to present something a bit fresh and new as well. But again, his party is still looking like a serious party that could conceivably get around 10% in elections, though that's not guaranteed. That might happen next year. But he certainly is not going to be a leader of an opposition government, it would seem. So in the short to medium term, there are no clear candidates for that political turnover that you're talking about, for that refreshing of the Polish political scene. And what we're going to see in 2023 is another contest between Jarosław Kaczynski and Donald Tusk. And if Jarosław Kaczynski wins, it will be an extraordinary crowning and culmination of his political career, with winning a third consecutive term, the first time that will have happened in post-1989 Polish politics. And if Donald Tusk wins, it will be one of the most amazing political returns of any country to have won two terms in government in 2007 and 2011, to leave, to go to Europe, to see his party blown away in two consecutive elections, and then to come back riding on the white horse, as the supporters of Tusk might see him, to lead the party to victory. At the moment, that seems like it could happen. But if it does, Tusk will be leading a coalition, as he was in 2007 and 2011. But it will be a bigger coalition of a number of opposition parties, and it will be very messy and probably quite chaotic. But I wouldn't write off PiS yet. They've shown themselves to be a very resilient party, and Kaczynski is a very resilient political player. So we'll see how that unfolds in the coming year.
Yeah, I don't think they're going anywhere for the time being. Stan, thank you very much.
Thank you.